My name is Scott Brown. Interviewing veteran is Angus Merrill, and it's April 2nd, 2005. What was your life like before the war?
Well, I worked in the woods as a lumberjack and in the mines when I was a kid, and silver and coal mines there in, out in Caldwell, Washington.
What was your family's livelihood?
I didn't get that.
What did your family do for a living?
Well, Dad worked in he worked in the quarry and logging, both of them. He worked in for U.S. Gypsum, and I can also say this: that back then, in the 30s. His wages were $1.42 a day. That's using a 22-pound hammer, breaking rock, and putting in 5,000 pounds at a time. So they earned their $1.42 a day. That's not an hour, that's a day. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mom was just a home. Seven of us kids, so she was had to stay home and cook bread about every other day.
Were you working or in school when you were growing up?
You mean before I went to service?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to high school. Yeah. Went to high school. And then during the summertime, we'll cut wood for the neighbor. We went out and log. And worked in the mines. I was single jack in a mine, and we both used dynamite, so it came in handy because I've been doing all the dynamite work for the sheriff of Soto County. The old dynamite that has to be blown, I know how to take care of it, and I do it. But that's what I did.
Were you single or were you married?
No, I was single. Before. Yeah, I was single.
Did you have any political leanings before the war? And what were they?
Political?
Yeah.
No, I didn't pay any attention. You know, back there in 1941, of course, that's when I graduated in 1941. No, none whatsoever. I do now, but I didn't then.
How did they get... How about your family? Did they have any political leanings at all? Or?
No, I don't really think so. My father-in-law, they were all Democrats, and that's what the kids all grew up as. You know, that was the first. That's much more important now than it was back then when you couldn't vote. You know, we couldn't vote old enough to vote.
What were your greatest daily concerns prior to the war?
What throws that off? Oh, I see. You got to hit a heat motion light. Yeah. The question again, what was it?
What were your greatest daily concerns prior to the war?
Well, I don't know, making sure that I could go out Saturday night and go dancing. I guess that's about the big thing. Back in those years, you know, you went to dances all over. Everybody had dances. We had dances at home. Dad built a big home out on a creek, China Creek, and we had dances there. When they quit in town at 2 o'clock, then everybody come out to our place and dance and have a breakfast come daylight. So that was always look forward to that, but that's about it.
What was your family's perception regarding military service?
They didn't mind at all. I mean, it's just something that you had to do. My brother's going to be drafted. Of course, you know, they're drafted, and I hadn't been notified, but I said, well, we have a choice of going to Alaska. We can go anywhere. You know, in 41, when we went over there, we got a choice of going 146th. feel Australian, go to Australia. And I said, I don't want to get down there, Australia. So the other choice was you go to Alaska. So I asked my brother, I said, well, let's go up to Alaska. And so we did. And it was great. I got to hunt for the Army, moose. I get one moose a day. I could get 8 bears and 40 goats if you wanted to get that many. But I hunted for the Army, for the outpost, for most of the time I was up there. So that was something that we really enjoyed.
Who was there anyone in your family or community who was a veteran of World War I or other conflicts?
Well, if they were, I doubt it. My whole, where I live now, was all Bohemians. They come in from, they're all foreigners, you know, and they come in there and took up land back in, 8, 9, and a lot of them up as late as 1913, and take Homestead Act, homesteads. So I doubt that any of them were in the service in World War I because they weren't here in World War I. So, and my dad was too old and for the service, and that was the end of that. I didn't have any relatives who were in World War I. But I knew a lot of them, later on, talked to them.
What were your perceptions of the war and its combatants prior to the U.S. entry?
Well, it's something that the Japanese jumped on us, and of course, like you said, I had, after we got arrested as spies, it made them, really made you wonder what was going on. Now, I don't know whether everyone asked me this question, what I think of this war, but I can sure tell you quick. I don't like it. I don't like it. We're killing too many people, and we didn't need to. We had 4 different places that the French, French Foreign Legion had people, 1,000 people, all ready to fight anywhere in the world. Turkey's had the same amount, and 2 other countries. They drop them down, and they clean those things out, and got him right away over there. We wouldn't have to put a troop over there. There was no bombs, nothing there, so it's all been proven a fact, but they didn't listen to me. I told them how to get the Foreign Legion in there because that's what they want to do. They want to fight. That's what they're designed to do.
What were your opinions regarding Germany and Japan before the war?
Well, I didn't like the Japanese because they jumped on us, but other than that, I had no idea. Nothing about Germany or Japan as far as they were just 2 countries you studied about, in high school.
What were your opinions regarding U.S. actions prior to the war?
Well, prior to the war, you had to, let me say this. You don't know everything that's going on today, and we didn't know then. What were we doing up there and putting outposts and completely around Seward? My brother was out on one side of the bay, Resurrection Bay, and I was on the other side. What we were doing, never know, the Japanese hadn't done anything to us at that time. That was well before Pearl Harbor. Why were we, somebody was getting ready. Of course, we didn't, we had no idea about the Japanese until Pearl Harbor, what they were up against, or Germany, as far as that goes. And and we were ill prepared for a war. In 1941, we had 3 3-inch guns, 17 rounds, and 3 of them went off when they did get some ammunition, and 3 of them, the others never went off. And if you can believe this or not, the bay, down around the bay where the docks were at Seward, were, I think there were 5 of them entrenched, was the old French 75. That's their field piece, the French 75. You probably never, if you didn't hear one, you probably never seen one. They were so outdated. Well, they were World War One and before French pieces. I don't know why they were sure. They were, Mickey Mouse had five Japs could have taken all of them off there in a hurry. But I call them Japs because I don't have much use for them. It's more being a medic right in the bag, and I didn't like that. Now I'm illusions.
How did you feel about isolationism?
What do you mean, to be isolated as an army, or?
Well, before the war, America's stance was to be isolationist. Did you have any feelings about that?
No, none whatsoever.
Where were you getting your information about Germany and Japan prior to the war?
After?
Or prior,
before? Or before? Well, whatever came, we had the only thing we had, you know, was the Sergeant Stripes. That's the only military outfit we had. And other than that, well, after you know, Germany was pile, and those guys gave it to you. But actually, before, they Pearl Harbor and they carried over, we were still up there. And no big deal. That's all there was to it. I had no of once they bombed and killed all those people over there at Pearl Harbor, then you had better start thinking they can do the same thing to you.
Where were you and what were you doing when you found out Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Well, that's when that picture there, that's when we got paid to 6th in the morning of the 7th, we were going up to the roadhouse, and that's when that colonel arrested us for being spies. And see, and this, that story was, you know, and he had us going out every single night. See, the town of Seward lived over here, and we were up against the Chugach Range mountains right behind us. And there was lights. They could spot lights up there. And I suppose they were signaling subs. I don't know. And I still don't know. But anyhow, that old colonel, those are spies up there. They are telling the Japanese how many people are down here and who they are and all about them. So the minute we were arrested in civilian clothes, no guns, no nothing, on and four in the front seat of that truck, and heading up the road, he said, "There's the people that use those lights. You four guys are under arrest. You're spies." Well, I'll tell you, if that old son of a gun hadn't gone nuts, I wouldn't be here. Did they intend to shoot us? That's what it was. Out in Lucians, there was an old Tokyo Rose used to come on and say there's 7,800 of them. Now, this is out in the Lucians. 7,800 on that island, Shemya. You're building an airport. On ADAC, then we went down to ADAC and was building some docks. And we were going to work one day, and down below us here was a plane. And the guy under it, he had a patch on and a firing squad, and that was it, one shot. The rest of them, you know, you're not guilty. Shot him. So that was part of the Army deal. And anyhow, the captain was worked down there on the dock. So I said, "What was that big deal?" And he said, "Well, Tokyo Rose is getting her information about these islands. He had a P-38 loaded with nothing but picture for taking picture cameras. And a big PBY come over, and I'd ridden them up there. Big, slow giants of a plane. And they'd gone over Paramushiro and took pictures. And here was his wing with that number sticking out from under him. They never covered it up. And so he was giving them, and he got, they said, well, they paid him or sent back to the States $8,000 for every one of those that he could verify for. And he was good at it. So, and he's one that they shot. He was a spy. And couldn't get any more guilty. The picture was there. The plane was there with the number on it. That's his plane. So they knocked him off. They they didn't us, because it was a little bit different situation, and that old, I guess, I never did get the full story of what that old colonel had to say and do before he went nuts. I have no idea what he had in mind.
Remember the colonel's name?
Colonel White was his name. His last name was White. I don't know what his first name was. But he was a full bird, and he'd been in the Army 34 years at that time. So I can see why you'd Army all those years and hadn't pointed at you and said, you're spies, and you're going to get it. So there's nothing we can do about it. Absolutely nothing.
Do you remember your family's response to Pearl Harbor being attacked?
Well, only one little thing. Before I went in the service, I bought a 1918 Model T for $10. And this old mining engineer put new rubber on it so I could take him around to different places, because he was an old retired mining engineer and he just wanted to go to mines. So I'd take him around that old 1918 Model T, and when I left and went in service, here they come around. They said, well, we've got to get junk there. The Japs are shooting at us, lead and iron, and we've got to get back to them fast. And Dad gave them that Model T. So that was the end of that. When I got back, I had it jacked up, and I didn't know how long I'd be in the service. And 4 years, and 8 months, and 23 days. Got back, it was gone. He said, well, they really put the pressure on us. And I said, well, it's gone, and that's it. But many years later, the guy that has all the Model Ts down at, that's where the old prison was. And he said he didn't have a 1918. I said, I had one. And well, he said, I'd pay a fortune for it. But it melted down. Army, or somebody got it, I suppose. I don't know where they're putting that stuff at. I have no idea. But it was gone.
What was your the community's response? People around you?
Well, really, like I said, you know, they were all from Czechoslovakia. They were Czechs, and every one of them completely around me. Lester Rutledge was the only, there were two Rutledges there, him and his first cousin. They owned ranches right there at Hop, at the local. But I have no idea what the rest of them even thought, you know. The Germans run over the top of them in a hurry in Poland, and so as of today, I can't imagine where that Pope went. You know, he was a Polish, and I don't know where he went during the war. He was over there. But I don't know where, how he got away from getting slaughtered the way a lot of the Poles got, because they got in the road. You know, they really slaughtered them.
How did you feel about Jeanette Rankin not voting for the war?
Jeanette Rankin? I don't know. It's just been something that's been brought up over the years, and I never really thought much of it. She was a different woman. She was my father-in-law knew her well. So she knows she was a Democrat. So I don't know. It was really nothing to me. Nothing.
How did you get involved in the military?
Well, like I said, my brother's going to be drafted. Douglas was his first name, and so I volunteered to go with him. We both went together and went in the service and trained there at Fort Lewis. Both went to Alaska, out to Lucians.
Why did you enlist?
Pardon me?
Why did you enlist? Well, I mean, sorry, what were your expectations when you enlisted?
Oh, I didn't have any other than being, if my brother, we were pretty close together, and you know, being brothers, worked together in the woods and the mines, and he had to be drafted, so I just got out of high school, you know, and so I went in with him. volunteering. That was April 11th.
Your basic training consist of, and for how long?
Well, I think it was 3 months before we went. We went right straight over there, and to Fort Lewis, and I don't know, I think we trained 3 months and then went up to Alaska, went up on the USS Taft, presidential ship, and stopped at Yakutat, the first stop was 1,000 miles out of Seattle, and then we went on out to, and then we stopped at some little island that didn't stay on, but we had to stay there that night because the ship was having problems, so the guy said, well, there's cots, army cots over there in that big building, and there's coal over there, and the Sibley stove. So if you want to set up a tent on a level place up there somewhere, we'll do it, and then tomorrow afternoon you're going to be gone. And so we did, built a fire, and in the middle of the night it got cold in there, and I said, my gosh. And I looked over there and there wasn't any stove, and what we'd done, we set the tent up on a little lake, and that stove had melted and went down into the water, so it was gone. And so that was pretty good, off and on about that one. They should add someone there to tell us where to set those tents up at instead of just anywhere. We found a level spot, it's nice and level. That water on a little lake is always nice and level. And it froze, but I don't know what island that was either. We were just there, it was just one of the Aleutians off the end out there, and then from there we went to Adak, and then back over to Kiska, and there wasn't anyone there. The Japs had already left there in the night, and built that airport on Shemya, runway, steel, and that's when I let my mother know where we were at, otherwise they'd never know. But I think I told you about Willowas that come up as high as 200 miles an hour. And they rolled up that deal, the whole thing, all steel mesh, and they were fastened together. Rolled it up, and there was two D8s on each side, cats. And unrolling had a big thing between them, and they were just unrolling that whole deal. So I told my mother in Life magazine, I said, if you think your cat is pretty, you ought to see that cat on page 48 or whatever it was in the Life magazine. So she got it because she liked cats, and she found out where we were at. Because they said they're unrolling it got rolled up on Shemya out in the Aleutians. So she knew where we was at. It was kind of tricky, and they let that go by. They didn't have a Life magazine, otherwise we'd have. It just, when she'd get a letter, she saved my letters, and I said, I don't want to look at some of those. You couldn't tell them anything, absolutely nothing, about your army life because they just blotted out, and they'd hardly make sense out of them.
Was basic training what you expected?
Yeah, just lots of running. Of course, we were in good shape working in the mines and the woods, and we weren't soft, we were both tough, and we could run, packs on, and no less, and I've been shooting ever since I was a kid, it's open sights, so up in Alaska, there was a captain, seemed like his name is Cook, he come down and get me because we had the old 17 Springfields, and boy, were they super accurate, but you couldn't flinch, and him and I get a 219 out of a 220 or 220, never less than 218, so he was always after me, because I was a good shot, and he liked that competition, so we had I got a lot of shooting in, just, but what good did it do, it didn't, it just something that he liked to do. He wasn't in my outfit either, even some other outfit. But when he saw us out there shooting, well, he wanted to get acquainted.
Were you kept informed of world affairs during basic training?
No, none whatsoever.
How was military life different from civilian life?
Well, you had to get up a certain time in the morning and take a shower. And of course, when I first went in, I didn't even have to shave. Just had peach fuzz, you know. And so, but no, it was different. It was, you know, different food, and you had to fall out and had to reveille in the morning and retreat at night. It was just different than civilian life, but it was something that was new to us, and we didn't mind it at all.
How do you feel about being away from home?
At that time, not at all. I never got homesick, not once, and neither my brother. We liked our folks real well, but we just it was just something we signed up to do, and we stayed with it. Never.
What do you remember most about basic training?
Well, shooting and you know, cleaning your gun, and then later on when we got the BARs, you know, they were a 1918 First World War gun, and you had to take them apart and put them back together, and you got so good at it, you had to go in a dark place just like this place is when you turn the lights out and do it in the dark, take them apart and put them together. But that just, it was just something that I suppose somewhere down the line we never had to do it, but that was, you were trained to do it in case, you know, you had parts or something. Other than that, no.
What did you like the most?
Well, I'll tell you, be frank with you, what I liked the most about basic training was, this might sound funny to you, but we never drank milk at home, and we had lots of cereal, and dry cereal and oatmeal, and I would be the first in line. I don't care what it was. When you went in, they had those quart bottles. They had the bottles over here of milk on there, and of course the cream is about that far down, and that's the thing I got. I'd be in there first so I'd get that cream. That's what, I mean, it's silly, but that was a fact. So, yeah, and other than that, well, all those exercises and running we were tough. You know, a lot of area out there, we'd hike for miles, and the one thing that was different, and I got a granddaughter that's a lieutenant now in the service, and they didn't do that while they were taking basic, but when we got back from a 20-mile hike down the ocean and back to Fort Lewis, you had to take your canteen off and dump it. No water was consumed during that hike. So you better have a puddle back there. If you didn't, you had to go around 10 times around the parade ground on the double. So everybody, when you pulled that off of there and unscrewed that and dumped it, it better be that water back there. So it's kind of silly to think of it, but, well, you have to do without water, you know. Might be times when you needed it or wanted it and you didn't have it. So that was one of the things, basically. But other than that, well, it was just every morning deal.
What did you do for recreation during basic training? Or did you have any?
Well, you got weekend passes if you could, you know, go. And we played a lot of baseball, but softball those years. Baseball, had baseball games up on the team as a pitcher. And just wrestling and having people come in, you know, people come in that fake boxing, you know, you'd think they'd hit each other, big noise, and they hadn't hit each other at all. you know, just things like that. But it was nothing big. Weekend, we either go to Olympia or Tacoma or Seattle. And you didn't make enough money to really go on any place, so you just more or less stayed at the camp. That's what it amounted to. Because we were getting $21 a month, and that didn't go very far. They took laundry out of that.
What was it like meeting people from around the country?
Pardon me?
What was it like meeting people from around the country?
Oh, I enjoyed that. I liked that. There were guys 7 foot tall, and he was a radio operator. He weighed 300 pounds, a great giant of a guy. He was not fat at all. And he went as far as Texas with us, and he was so big that we were moving jeeps when I joined the 3rd. Patton's outfit and we had tanks, but we had to move a bunch of jeeps to North Camp Hood, and he backed over too far. He had to take the front seat out, and he drove from the back seat because one shoe was 22 and one was 23. Special shoes Army got for him, 5 in a big box. And so he backed down too far, and that little jeep would not pull out of there, rear up a little bit. And I said, "What in the hell are you doing? What the heck are you doing backing down over there?" I said, "We got to get that thing back up here, find a chain or something." And he got all that doggone thing, went back there and lifted that jeep right up and put her right up on the sidewalk, just like that, boy. That's how big and strong he was. So he said, How does that suit you? And I said, "Fine." I said, "I'm sure glad I'm not monkeying with you." No, he's just a big, strong guy. But I don't know, I adjusted well to the Army. I didn't mind at all because everything was new experience to me. And even when you were facing danger, well, you know, you didn't like things I should have known better than shooting at that bed check Charlie and getting that ricochet in the hip. I should have known better than to do that, but sometimes you do things that you shouldn't have done. We were in, I'll just say this because it has nothing to do, but I always like to, we were moving all the time. We were, you know, over there in the 3rd, we were on the road all the time. This ricochet, a woman called me up here 3-4 years ago, and she said, "Well, Angus, all my records burned up in 72 fire back there. I don't have any records back in St. Louis. And all those records burned up." But she said, "If you can tell me that doctor's name and where it was actually at, we can get you a Purple Heart," because I didn't get a Purple Heart for that. And I said, "Well, ma'am," I said, "that was back here about 40 years ago, and I have a hunch, or closer to 50, and I said, I have a hunch that doctor is probably gone." I said, "He had to be much older than I was to been a doctor." "Oh, that's right." And another time, we got pulled off the road. Some captain pulled us off. It wasn't Patton. It was some captain pulled us off the road. And wanted us to unload the tank. I said, "We don't unload tanks." And he said, "Well, just stay right here. And it's going to be pitch black. And just stay here and have your guns out." And I thought, my God, what the heck is this? People, we stood there, this Eddie, he's from Paulsville, Washington. And there was people, they must have had a rope. And they were, I have a hunch it was a French underground. I still, neither one of us know what it was. It hadn't been something with the French, because when this guy, of course, took our name, and the French government said, "Well, they're going to give us this deal that goes over your shoulder." I don't know, it's a French name for a medal. They gave us $19 a month for all around while we was over there. The French government did. So that was the end of that one. But see, you're on the move. So if you're in the, like, if I'd been the 163rd and up there in the front line or the artillery, and I got this ricochet, you'd have been put in a Purple Heart immediately. Fact is, you'd have got your Purple Heart. They give them to them on the battlefield. But we were traveling, and I just got this thing. They tore my Eisenhower jacket all to hell, and took care of that. But well, he said, "I'll take your name, and we'll send you a Purple Heart. And when you get back home, civilian." I never ever saw it. And I didn't, but it was no big deal. And another thing that was perhaps, and it was really a funny thing. I spent a lot of time investigating this, but we got on a ship to go to Europe, and all of a sudden we got in that Bermuda Triangle, and a storm. You wouldn't believe in this bully from and this Ed, the driver I was with. Later on, we were on the back of this ship, and every time it come up, it the big old boy is a huge ship. So there'd be a big banging down in there, and this captain come and he said, "I want to volunteer to go down and stop that engine. There's an engine loose down there." Where we thought, "What the hell is this?" And so he said, "We got a hatch, and that wave went crossing over the top, and we got down in there. It was straight down, right on the side like that, and you'd never know it was in there. There's only two like them in the world at that time, and we was on one. It was a 48 eight-wheel engine with their tenders on four high. The entire body is all big, the old freight engines." And that's a crazy thing. It must be time too. And anyhow, we went down, and down to far end was an engine that was backing up. Well, he said, I could see the situation. He said, "If that goes off the track, it'll go right through the side of the ship, and we'll sink in a matter of a minute, and you could never get away." So we kept blocking it up. We had some big blocks that looked like stuff from the coast, or clear wood. And I'd say, "Now," and it just smashed that stuff all to pieces. But along the side of the ship, floating along there, the water up above our ankles, and was some old black wood. So we got those, and we finally got it stopped. And buckled it down, and then buckled the front first, and then the back, and got it all tightened down, went back up, and he said, "I think it was sabotage. I think that was never fastened in there right to begin with." He said, "You saved the ship, 48 eight-wheelers, your outfit, and all of our crew." And I said, "Well, why didn't part of your crew go down there?" He said, "They refused." I said, "That's treason on the high seas, fella." I said, "They would be shot when we get off that in Cherbourg. They'll be shot." "No," he said, "we're not United States Army." But he wouldn't say what they were. And he said, "I'm putting you in for a Congressional Medal of Honor for saving all these people. And I don't know what else, Silver Stars." And we never saw any of that shit either. I'm sorry about that.
That's good.
Never saw any of it. So you see, there's times when you did those things, and I didn't expect anything, you know. Otherwise, we would have never made it into Bermuda. We were there 10 days. It'd go up so high that it bent the drive. It had twin ones out behind, and it bent the shaft that goes down to one, and so we were there 10 days getting that fixed. So we did have fun there on Bermuda. It was all English, you know, and mostly colored people at that time. So we did save the sucker, but all I can do is tell a story about it. We didn't get anything for it. But were here, and we wouldn't have been here if that thing would have gone over off that track. Well, you've probably seen those big old eight-wheelers. They were big, solid steel, and had the tenders on them. 48 of them in that ship, four high, and across, and well, I'll tell you something. I had no idea what was down in there. Riding up, we were right up in the front, and I think there was 50 of us in my outfit that time that went over there, and then there was some unit back on the other end of the ship, just a little, wouldn't be half the size of this room, and bunks there, you know, and that's where we were at. So we, and then they were going to, it was always suspicious because, and then he said, by the way, he said, another thing you can do is watch out for submarines because we're on Coffin's Corner. And the Coffin's Corner, the ship's out. We saw tankers go under and never come up. And the one on the outside went down and never come up. They sunk. That's the kind of storm it was. Severe, very severe storm. And I said, well, he said, I want you out here and watch for submarines. Stethoscopes come up and take a look at us. And, what the heck? You know, we hadn't been out there a half hour and one out there, and man, I had let a beller out and these guys were taking their guns off up overhead, and they weren't Army. And then another one come up and said, there's two of them. Well, I expected to get, that would have been the end of it, because we weren't ever close to Bermuda, yes. It was close, but the triangle. And so that says they were British, and they pulled up alongside us, and we got in the dock here, Bermuda, and we got to go into them and look them over. I sure didn't want to be in a submarine. Little narrow thing, I don't know. But they wanted, when we left, that we were going to circle down about 12-15,000 miles to get back around to Cherbourg and zigzag all the way. And they volunteered to take us both, one on each side of that ship. No, the captain says, I don't want you along at all. So they didn't, they were there when we left Bermuda. But we did get to rum. Black rum was 40 cents a full course, and it was 130, I think, 140. So you didn't take many sips of that, and you didn't know which direction you was going. And bicycle was the only thing that was allowed on those between St. George and St. John, Bermuda. So if you wanted to, and there was a little train. I still got the ticket at home of my train ride back from St. George to St. John, and a little ticket they punched for that little train. And it was just about that wide, little wee tracks, and about 10 cars, and well, kind of like a toy, like the kids have. That was our trip. But you see, sometimes you do things and don't get recognized for it, but it's no big deal. I got plenty of those ribbons being in both places, you know, in the Asiatic Pacific and over there in West Patton. So, no, and the kids all know my history, so. Am I going to get some of this too?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. I like that. So, well, let's continue on. What do you got? What did I do for what?
I know I asked you this earlier, but I want to get this recorded. What was your time like in the Asiatic Pacific, Alaska, and Aleutians?
What was it like?
Yeah, what was your time like? What did you spend your job?
Well, out in Aleutians, you know, we had to dig under because of wind. We set up, the rest of our unit was coming up from Sitka, so we set up a big kitchen tent and all their tents, and fasten them down 5 foot. See, they don't have soil up there. It's just it's tundra, and then it's just a funny stuff. It's firm, but you can dig it out real easy. And we set them up. Next morning, they were coming in, and There was not one single tent. The Willowad just cleaned them right out, took them out in the ocean, so they were gone. But we dug under, and the thing that was that I enjoyed most, and maybe each one of us had a skull on the front of our tent out there on Shemya, because over on one side was a mound almost high as this, and they'd been there for centuries after centuries, the Lutes, and they'd brought their fish in, I suppose, or whales, or whatever they got, and so they had lots of ivory. Oh, they didn't, ivory was nothing to them. So I had even found a ivory, it looked like a comb, and but we couldn't get any of the ivory back to the States. None of it whatsoever. So, but we'd go up there and dig, and here would be a skeleton, you know, with a skull, and I suppose his personal belongings. I know I probably shouldn't have dug in there, but we didn't have anything else to do. Wait for old, she'd, every night, you know, tell us what we were doing, and your water is poisoned, and I hope it killed y'all, and old Tokyo Rose. And, but, no, that was one of our things, but I will tell you a funny incident that happened. My brother and the captain were pretty good friends. I mean, they were scuffling along, you know, but they were coming down for inspection at our tents. And of course, we were all dressed up, you know, and bed made where you drop a 50-cent piece on and it'd bounce. But this captain, our bathrooms didn't exist. They were in the ground, and the water would not go down any whatsoever. So you had two holes with the tundra around, certainly had that turned back, and we filled the, for where you peed, we filled it up and had that on it. And so here comes the captain. He wasn't going to stay on that boardwalk that you had to have because of all these all over around. And he went in right up to his neck in that old pee. So they took him back up on there with changed clothes. They had a colonel with him, and that colonel was just dying laughing. He said, well, we told him not to take any shortcuts.